Well, good morning, everybody, and a very warm welcome to today's event. And I'd like to, first of all, thank you all for coming, speakers and participants. So thank you very much for coming along to today's event. And I'd also like to say thank you to the Leaving Trust and the Centre for European and International Studies Research for their support for today's event. Now, the event is hosted by the Francophone Africa Research Cluster, which is now in its 15th year. And during that time, the cluster's research has focused on two main areas: the reassessment of the legacy of French colonialism in Africa and in metropolitan France, and secondly, on the changing relations between France and the Francophone world. Another key theme is reflected in the cluster, the Francophone Africa cluster's blog, Rethinking Francophone Africa. And posts on the blog reflect this questioning: what is Francophone Africa? What does Francophone Africa mean today in the 21st century? At one level, of course, the answer is, or may appear, simple. It refers to the study of the history, politics, societies and cultures of those parts of Africa formerly under French colonial rule. Yet this is actually problematic. How many of those living in these parts of Africa are actually French speakers? And is there not the danger in adopting the term of suggesting that we're studying Africa through a Eurocentric lens? Or conversely, is there not the danger that some might think we're using the term to denounce neocolonialism and in the process reproducing an ahistorical view of Africa, of a continent still stuck in a set of dependent relations characteristic of the colonial era? Moreover, the French government further contributes to the confusion by describing the Democratic Republic of Congo on its embassy website in Kinshasa as the largest francophone country in the world. Yet the Democratic Republic of Congo was never a French colony. Many of these themes are present in today's programme. Our first panel has as its starting point a large body of work which has in recent years sought to place the end of empire at the centre of our understanding of the history of the French Fifth Republic. Challenging the notion of a decolonisation watershed in 1960-62, these works have explored the many ways in which the ending of empire has been constitutive of contemporary France. In so doing, this work has focused on studying the many continuities between the colonial and the post-colonial era. And this issue of continuities is, of course, quite differently expressed in Africa and presents a different set of challenges for the historian of post-independence Africa. In the second panel, contributors will question the usefulness of the post-colonial framework for understanding the modern world, while in the third panel, the varied aspects of the post-colonial beyond academia will be explored. So why are we holding this event today? Well, because in many ways it's a propitious moment to hold such an event. It marks the culmination of Ed Naylor's 3-year Leverhulme Early Career Fellowship, in which he's been exploring how ideas of marginality were reshaped by decolonisation through a detailed case study of Marseille from the 1950s to the 1970s. It also enables us to mark and celebrate Margaret Majumdar's retirement as research professor here at the University of Portsmouth and her appointment as emeritus professor. Margaret joined us as visiting professor in 2003, shortly after the formation of the Francophone Africa Research Cluster. So her history at University of Portsmouth and that of the Research Cluster are closely intertwined. For 10 years, from 2003 to 2013, she was She was visiting professor, and in 2013 was appointed research professor. She's been extremely active during this period, serving for a time as secretary of the Association for the Study of Modern and Contemporary France, publishing many books and articles, supervising and examining PhD students, mentoring early career researchers, and organising events, the most recent of which was an international conference on the idea of progress, which led to the publication of two journal special issues in the International Journal of Francophone Studies and Interventions. Margaret has published widely on political philosophy and on theory. She's written extensively on the Francophone world in the post-colonial context, and especially on Franco-Maghrebi relations. Indeed, many of the themes that we shall be exploring today are ones that underpin Margaret's work. In a career spanning over 30 years, she has explored, among many others, issues relating to decolonisation. She has applied and discussed post-colonial theory in cultural and literary studies. She has raised questions about post-colonial theory and been central to discussions of new theoretical approaches beyond the post-colonial. So, as we revisit and take forward these themes today, this is also an opportunity to celebrate Margaret's distinguished contribution to these important debates.
Thank you very much, Tony, for those introductory remarks, which has set everything up so well. I'm just going to add a couple of really quite practical points to that, to the organisation. First of all, to reiterate thanks to everyone who's made the effort to come here today. Some of you have come from quite a long way away and at quite short notice. So I think the eagerness with which people responded to our invitation says a lot about the intellectual and personal ties that Margaret has forged during her career across many institutions and countries. So that was fantastic. The second thing I wanted to say was about the panels. What we sort of asked people to do today was to bring 10 or 15 minutes of comments and remarks around quite a broad theme, to really interpret that in their own way. The idea of this is really to promote discussion as much as possible, interaction, questions, and leaving enough time for sort of flowing discussions, which we often don't always have at some conferences where fantastic papers come and then we're stuck with 5 minutes sort of rushing to get out to the next coffee break. So hopefully we won't have too much of that today. What I'm really going to do is just introduce the panellists one by one as they speak. They'll each have 10 to 15 minutes, and then we'll open it up for questions. Okay, so I'm going to hand over to myself as the chair of the first session, and I'll be relatively brief on this. So the title of the first panel is The Remaking of France? New Histories of Decolonisation. And I'm sure you've noticed The Remaking of France is coming from Todd Shackle's book from 2006, The Invention of Decolonisation, which over a decade on continues to attract interest and critique and sort of provoking discussion. I suppose there's two points I want to make about that related to this panel. The first is that in many ways, The Remaking of France, The Invention of Decolonisation has been critiqued, sometimes I think from a rather misleading angle, which is to say that it's really, the title tells it, it's really a book about France rather than Algeria. And this has sometimes created some, I think, confusion or difficulty about the place of Algerians, Algerian nationalism and the FLN in that book. And the reason I mention that is because I think one of the underlying maybe themes in this session is the question of whether new histories of decolonization as related to France and metropolitan France have very much to offer historians of other parts of the world. So the sense of an imperial republic, the sense of decolonization as a watershed, as Tony put it, being at the heart of the history of the post-war French Republic, fourth and fifth Republic, does that actually help us as historians of Algeria or Senegal or other spaces? Now, are we actually doing the same kind of work when we're thinking about decolonization? And I think our panel, which has specialists of France, French regionalism, France and politics of the veil, and at the same time specialists of Algeria and post-independence Algeria, and specialists of colonial archives, the empire in Africa and in the Pacific, means that we've got really quite a good range of perspectives on this. So we'll see what comes out of that. I'm going to hand over first of all to Fabienne Chameleau. But before I do that, I should say one more thing. Le titre de notre journée, c'est Beyond the Postcolonial, au-delà du postcolonial. Donc, ça suggérait un certain bilinguisme qui n'est pas tout à fait respecté dans le fait. Mais cela n'empêche qu'on aura au moins deux intervenants qui vont parler en français, ce qui est très bienvenu. Et évidemment, les discussions, les questions peuvent poser dans la langue que vous souhaitez. Et si nécessaire, on a essayé de traduire un petit peu. So English and French very much interchangeable for our day and our discussions. So Fabienne Chameleau is close to completing her PhD here at Portsmouth, a very active member of the Francophone Africa Research Cluster. Her PhD concerns the history of colonial archives in Indochina, French Indochina, and in the AOF, French West Africa, Afrique Occidentale Française, and she's just very recently returned, I think yesterday or the day before, from an extended period of fieldwork in Vietnam and Senegal, and I think she's going to share some reflections on that. Mm-hmm. So over to you, Fabienne.
Well, thank you very much. And thank you for the introduction, but also for putting this together with Margaret and giving me the opportunity to present the paper. I'm going to switch to French. En écrivant ce papier, en fait, j'ai démarré tous mes paragraphes en anglais et pour une raison que j'ai pas compris, je l'ai terminé en français. Donc je me suis dit qu'il valait mieux le faire en français, que ce serait plus simple. Je pense que c'est parce que je reviens d'un terrain et tout ça, enfin voilà quoi. Comme l'expliquait Ed, moi, paradoxalement, en fait, je vais articuler ma présentation plus pas trop sur la France, justement, mais plutôt sur l'expérience que je viens d'avoir au cours d'un séjour de recherche au Sénégal, où j'étais pour faire des recherches dans les archives. Et en fait, il m'a semblé bien de profiter de l'opportunité de cette journée pour aborder la question du postcolonial sous un angle plutôt empirique, en fait, puisque, effectivement, enfin, en tant que jeune chercheuse, doctorante française, se retrouvant au Sénégal, faisant des recherches sur l'histoire coloniale à Dakar, je trouvais qu'en termes empiriques et en termes d'approche du terrain concret, ça a soulevé des questions auxquelles j'ai absolument aucune réponse, mais qui sont quand même, enfin qui sont néanmoins intéressantes à soulever, je pense. Et donc ce sera plutôt des observations que je vais présenter ici et qui éventuellement amèneront déboucheront sur des questions lors de la discussion ou des choses plus approfondies. Donc avant toute chose aussi, quand on emploie le terme de post-colonial ou post-colonial studies dans le contexte français, je suis toujours un peu interloquée parce que ça me semble, J'ai toujours la sensation d'un décalage complet, en fait, dans la mesure où en France, on n'a même pas vraiment de colonial studies. En fait, c'est un champ qui est encore complètement à ouvrir. Les chercheurs français qui travaillent sur l'histoire de la colonisation sont en général dans l'histoire des aires culturelles. Il n'y a pas vraiment de recherche, de département en tout cas, ou de champ de recherche qui est directement consacré, je ne sais pas, à l'Empire français, etc. Moi, il y a encore quelques années, quand je faisais mon master, il fallait que j'argumente auprès de mon directeur de mémoire en France que j'employais le terme d'empire pour parler du domaine colonial français. Quoi. C'était pas encore gagné et c'était il n'y a pas si longtemps. Donc du coup, la question du post-colonial dans le contexte français m'interroge toujours. Et je pense que c'est peut-être aussi pour ça qu'il y a il y a beaucoup de décalages dans les réceptions qui sont faits en France sur ces questions-là, avec peut-être des termes du débat qui sont posés de façon un petit peu bancale, parce qu'il y a quand même un trou assez conséquent en France. Pour moi, à titre en tant que jeune chercheuse, ça se pose de façon concrète, ayant fait ma scolarité en France, étant produit de la culture française et du système éducatif français. Quand j'ai commencé à m'intéresser à l'histoire de la colonisation, à l'histoire des archives coloniales, je me suis rendu compte qu'en France, justement, bon, qu'il y avait encore des notions qui bloquaient et que la façon dont les termes du débat étaient posés, notamment dans le monde anglophone, permettaient des ouvertures qu'on n'avait pas encore en France à l'époque. Il n'y a pas de jugement de valeur, hein, c'est ni moins bien ni mieux, c'est juste différent et je pense que les deux se complètent de façon très intéressante. Du coup, je pense que, dans la façon dont je rédige ma thèse, en fait, la question post-coloniale, ça s'articule autour de deux choses qui me semblent être extrêmement importantes, qui est d'une part de décentrer son regard, donc de sortir d'une histoire eurocentrée ou centrée sur la France. Ça se fait de deux façons, aussi bien sur le fond, sur la façon dont on utilise ses sources finalement, et la façon dont on va projeter finalement son propre parcours ou ses propres questionnements sur ses sources. Et du coup, de manière réflexive également, pour savoir d'où on parle finalement et quel point de vue on adopte quand on mène un sujet, quand on travaille sur ces sujets-là. Et il y a aussi la question des continuités postcoloniales et la façon dont elles s'inscrivent dans les sujets de recherche qui traitent de la colonisation. Donc il y aurait beaucoup de choses à dire aussi bien sur le terrain que sur le sujet de recherche en lui-même. Je ne vais pas me concentrer sur mon sujet de recherche parce que justement, comme je l'ai dit, je reviens tout juste du Sénégal et je trouvais intéressant de se concentrer sur cet aspect-là. Lors de mon séjour au Sénégal, il y a trois aspects qui m'ont particulièrement marqué et qui touchent aux questions postcoloniales. D'une part, les rapports interpersonnels, en fait, sur lesquels je ne vais pas m'étendre parce que c'est finalement assez subjectif. Enfin, j'ai pas le temps déjà. Et puis, c'est assez subjectif aussi, mais c'est vrai qu'il y a dans la façon dont les chercheurs interagissent, je pense, et notamment les jeunes chercheurs interagissent avec les archivistes, il y avait énormément de tensions qui étaient soulevées et qui, je trouvais, ne s'articulaient pas de la même façon selon qu'on est en contexte sénégalais, par exemple, ou en contexte français. Aix-en-Provence, par exemple, les tensions avec les archivistes vont, je trouve, pas être gérées du tout de la même façon et avec, me semble-t-il, moins de condescendance que certaines réflexions que j'ai pu entendre vis-à-vis des archivistes sénégalais. Et je me suis demandé dans quelle mesure le fait d'être dans un contexte sénégalais, changer en fait tous ces rapports-là et les modes de communication même qu'il y a. Donc ça, c'est extrêmement épineux et complexe et puis extrêmement subjectif. Donc je ne vais pas m'étaler, mais il y a quand même, enfin moi j'ai trouvé qu'il y avait des choses assez choquantes quand même qui se passaient. Ensuite le deuxième aspect, c'est le dispositif qu'on peut qui est plutôt institutionnel en fait et sur lequel je veux plus développer et qui en lui-même génère des inégalités en fait et soulève la question des continuités entre la période coloniale et postcoloniale, mais qui permet aussi d'ouvrir des nouveaux champs en fait et peut-être des nouvelles perspectives. Puisque c'est ça, on n'est pas que des la question du postcolonial, c'est qu'on n'est pas que des individus qui évoluons au gré de notre libre arbitre, mais on est bien dans des dispositifs qui sont aussi enfermants et avec lesquels il faut, avec lesquels il faut faire et qu'il faut aménager. Le troisième aspect donc, que j'ai déjà mentionné et que je ne traiterai pas, c'est vraiment sur la question des continuités au niveau des archives coloniales. Il y aurait beaucoup à dire, j'ai absolument pas le temps de m'étendre, mais voilà, sur vraiment qu'est-ce que ça veut dire que pour un pays comme le Sénégal de réintégrer les archives coloniales au sein de leurs archives nationales en fait. Comment ça se négocie en termes de cadre de classement? Comment ça se négocie en termes logistiques? Est-ce qu'on ouvre un centre différent qui sépare les archives contemporaines de l'État indépendant des archives coloniales? Est-ce qu'on fait un centre commun qui va créer de fait une continuité et des liens et des ponts entre ces archives et ces sources? Voilà, et ça c'est aussi un des aspects, mais du coup ce sera plus dans ma thèse, il y aurait largement de quoi faire. Donc en fait, en tant que Française, moi, par rapport à l'histoire coloniale, en fait, j'ai déjà, mon parcours par rapport à mon sujet a évolué avec les voyages que j'ai pu faire, en fait, justement, en essayant d'aller voir un petit peu ailleurs ce qui se passait. Donc ça a commencé avec un séjour de recherche aux États-Unis, à New York. J'ai pu faire une année à New York University. C'était la première fois que j'étais dans un département de French Studies. Et c'était la première fois que j'abordais l'histoire de France, et notamment l'histoire coloniale française, avec un regard qui n'était pas français, tout simplement. En fait. C'est aussi bête que ça, c'est aussi simple que ça. Et c'était extrêmement intéressant de voir ce décalage du regard, en fait, de voir ce qui était fait de l'histoire de France depuis les États-Unis, et qui était déjà donc une première étape sur le fait de décentrer un petit peu le regard. Arrivée ensuite à l'université de Portsmouth au sein du Francophone Africa Research Cluster, là ça m'a permis de franchir, il me semble, une autre étape qui était que là encore on faisait, il y avait toujours un décentrage du regard, mais qui permettait là peut-être de faire plus l'histoire de l'Empire français sans faire l'histoire de France. Aux États-Unis on restait encore comme c'était un département de French Studies. On restait encore dans une perspective qui était finalement centrée autour de la France, l'histoire de la colonisation et l'histoire de l'Empire français, à partir de la France comme le centre, en fait. La métropole égale le centre, etc. Et c'est vrai que d'arriver ici à Portsmouth, ça m'a permis de pouvoir questionner cette posture-là et de pouvoir finalement faire l'histoire de l'Empire français sans nécessairement faire l'histoire de France, quoi. L'histoire de la France, un acteur parmi d'autres. Et donc là, plus récemment au Sénégal, donc j'ai pas encore pris la mesure vraiment de tout ce que ça impliquera pour mon travail, mais c'était une expérience extrêmement enrichissante et vraiment fantastique, parce que toutes ces questions, justement, tous ces débats qu'on peut avoir ici sur l'eurocentrisme, sur comment ne pas faire de la France le centre et le cœur, comment ne pas adopter le point de vue français quand on fait de l'histoire de la colonisation française, en fait c'est, et encore une fois hein, c'est tout bête à dire, mais c'est une réalité, C'est qu'au Sénégal, ça se fait tout seul, quoi. Je veux dire, il y a juste à arriver là-bas, à se taire, et à écouter les débats universitaires, les chercheurs discuter, et à s'en inspirer. Et c'était extrêmement riche dans ce sens-là, parce que ça touchait à vraiment quelque chose de concret et de réellement empirique, loin de débats qui peuvent être parfois extrêmement abstraits ou parfois assez abscons. Enfin, voilà, il y a quand même des choses dans la théorie postcoloniale qui, des fois, sont assez difficiles à aborder. Et c'est vrai que cette expérience au Sénégal a été fantastique pour ça, puisque de fait, voilà, c'est des chercheurs qui arrivent à articuler tous ces points de vue beaucoup plus facilement et naturellement, je pense, qu'on peut le faire ici, et encore plus en France. Donc voilà, il y a aussi en dehors de cet aspect aussi assez qui touche à l'approche de la du terrain et des opportunités que ça peut ouvrir. J'étais aussi étonnée en termes de vraiment de dispositifs de recherche, de voir que justement la question des continuités est extrêmement concrète là aussi pour les chercheurs sénégalais. Il y a un laboratoire à Dakar où j'ai pu rencontrer des chercheurs et travailler, qui est un laboratoire mixte européen et sénégalais, avec des chercheurs qui sont de toute nationalité européenne et africaine, francophone. Et c'est vrai que il y avait quand même des décalages qu'on mentionne pas suffisamment, je pense, et qui sont extrêmement matériels en fait, en termes de niveau de vie tout simplement. C'est vrai que quand on arrive au Sénégal, n'étant pas riche, etc., on arrive dans un pays où on a un confort matériel et un niveau de vie qui est quand même qui est énorme par rapport au reste de la population. Mais aussi dans la dynamique de travail entre les chercheurs. Dans ce laboratoire, en fait, il y avait tout le dispositif de recherche de façon complètement involontaire. En fait, n'était pas du tout à même de proposer des solutions à certaines problématiques concrètes, comme les demandes de visa, par exemple. Et donc l'accès aux sources et l'accès au terrain, tout simplement. Et c'était assez frappant de voir que, même encore en étant au Sénégal et en faisant la démarche soit d'aller vers les archives, qui constituent une exception, je veux dire, c'est les archives coloniales françaises ont toutes été ramenées sur le territoire métropolitain, excepté celle de l'AOF. Donc on est déjà dans une dynamique où quand même c'est à nous d'aller vers ces archives et pas aux chercheurs des anciennes colonies d'aller en France pour continuer à faire leur histoire. Donc même avec ce dispositif-là, avec le fait que c'est à nous d'aller vers les sources, les problèmes économiques et les inégalités économiques restent de façon frappante, quoi. Avec tout simplement des questionnements, avec des questionnements sur la façon dont on va gérer son temps et son budget pour faire des demandes de visa, et avec des contraintes vraiment flagrantes. Enfin, voilà, moi j'ai un chercheur sénégalais de ce laboratoire. Qui a dû repousser d'un mois et demi son terrain parce qu'il n'a pas accès au visa, tout simplement, et parce que, à cause de lenteur administrative, il n'y a même pas particulièrement de problème avec son dossier. C'est juste que c'est extrêmement lent. C'est un budget énorme pour lui que n'ont pas les Français. Et ça conduisait, en fait, en discutant avec lui, c'était vraiment intéressant de voir à quel point ça conduit quand même à un isolement au sein du laboratoire. Et un clivage entre les chercheurs français, enfin ou européens en tout cas, et les chercheurs africains dans ce laboratoire, qui se surajoute en fait à des différences de pratiques de socialisation. Et c'était extrêmement intéressant à observer en termes sociologiques, et je pense que ça soulève des questions extrêmement concrètes qui ne sont pas directement liées à la recherche en elle-même et mais vraiment dispositif d'accueil des chercheurs. Et encore une fois, avec une question ouverte, il n'y a pas forcément de réponse à ça, la question des visas, on n'est pas, les laboratoires sont un petit peu impuissants par rapport à ça. Mais c'est des questions qui sont facilement survolées, je trouve, et que je trouve quand même intéressantes à rappeler et à mentionner. Voilà, et puis comme je le disais aussi plus tôt sur une note, et je termine là, sur une note un peu plus positive, c'est que justement en termes de sortie d'une espèce de d'eurocentrisme, pouvoir avoir l'opportunité de discuter avec des chercheurs francophones africains qui maîtrisent aussi bien le champ anglophone, européen, américain, et le champ, les champs anglophones et francophones d'Afrique, ça offre des perspectives, des opportunités qui sont extrêmement, extrêmement riches et extrêmement porteuses, je trouve. Et c'est vrai que c'est des ponts, on a beau communiquer et échanger au cours de nos recherches, il y a finalement assez peu de ponts qui sont faits et de plateformes qui sont offertes aux chercheurs africains, alors que c'est vrai, enfin c'est vrai que toutes ces questions-là en fait pourraient être enfin dans un monde idéal et parfait, etc. Il pourrait apporter une perspective qui permettrait de dépasser des débats qui sont parfois théoriques. Et qui pour eux s'ancrent vraiment dans un quotidien, dans une trajectoire particulière, et qui relève d'une évidence, quoi, que nous on n'a pas forcément immédiatement. Voilà, et je vais m'arrêter.
Thank you very much, Fabienne. We're going to go straight on to the next speaker. So. Briefly introduce Sherry Pjeni from the University of South Wales. Worked there for a number of years with Margaret, in fact, and you were telling me earlier about the inspiration and input that she's had in his work, notably the monograph, which I think you may be referring to today, which is entitled French Muslims, which came out in 2010 and discussed the politics of the veil, among other things. And more recently, quite a shift in subject, have a new monograph which is coming out in November, I think, called The Hippie Trail, which is analysing experiences of travel across Asia. So I'll hand over to Sherry.
Thank you. It really is a pleasure to be here today. It's a slightly odd experience for me today, because I'm waiting to become emeritus professor. Margaret has just beaten me to it. Congratulations. I will be talking about what was called at the time the War of the Veil, and I think it's a title which gets to sound more and more suitable as the years go by. But I do want to just start off with a couple of reflections about Margaret. While she was working at what was the University of Glamorgan, I did have the privilege of sharing a conference platform with Margaret several times, and I was able to observe, if you like, the Majumdar style. A couple of things that came out. Margaret is a very precise speaker. She speaks in a level voice, but very clearly, a lot of life, a lot of bounce in her voice. But the amazing thing is that Margaret always comes with a complete text, word for word, and it's hard to believe it, but you know, 20, 30, 40 minutes, she is reading out the text, but she's reading it with life in her voice, with vivacity in her voice, and she's the only academic I know who can actually do that over a whole conference paper. It's not a great achievement, she has done many more things, but it's one thing about her conference style. The other thing about Margaret and conference papers, always, no matter how important the paper, how important the conference, how important the audience, Margaret always writes her paper the evening before. And if she writes it any earlier, she tears up the earlier version and then gets to the great version. So I felt that, yeah, when I was on the train this morning and putting some notes together, this was like a petty homage to Margaret that I was following in her footsteps that far. Margaret had actually left the university, unfortunately, by the time I got on to writing this book, but the book came out of conversations we had together and I think common interests. It was a departure for me. I mean, prior to writing this book, I'd really been a historian of 19th century France, and I did enjoy being a historian of 19th century France, but I felt it was something of a straitjacket and I was looking to get out of it, really. I hadn't got much experience in this matter at all. I didn't know any. Actually, I knew one Muslim. There were a couple of distant family members who did wear veils, but I mean, I hardly knew them. I'd met them, so I was coming really to this topic pretty much in complete ignorance. And the story I tell right at the beginning of the book is the absolute truth. There were two events at the end of 2003 that really struck me. Probably you don't remember, but 2003 was a very, very hot summer. I mean, it was an absolutely sort of murderous heat wave. And at the end of the summer, September 2003, this isn't funny at all, the Paris municipality found it was in possession of a number of corpses, people who had died in that heat wave who were anonymous. Usually they were tramps or down and outs. And the municipality had to do something. So the Paris municipality arranged a sort of collective funeral for these down and outs. And the thing that makes it different, if you like, is Chirac at the time was prime minister. Chirac at the time was president. And Chirac said he would attend the funeral because even a tramp was a member of the Republic, a citizen of the Republic, and even a tramp merited a Republican funeral. And the amazing thing about this, no photographs, no cameras. You know, Chirac knew how to do this. It was this astonishing gesture of, if you like, Republican solidarity, Republican integration. And, all right, I'm not a fan of Chirac, but I couldn't help being blown away by that gesture. It was then amazing that just a couple of months later, it's not quite a mirror opposite, but Chirac got involved in a very different sort of debate. And this was in Tunisia in December 2003. Chirac, in an apparently spontaneous question and answer session with Tunisian students, told them that French people were right to be worried about veil-wearing schoolgirls. And the contrast between the two is quite amazing. I mean, one was this eloquent gesture of Republican idealism. Everyone was going to be included. But by December 2003, the barriers are coming up, if you like, that certain people are less members of the Republic than others. I was very surprised by that second announcement from Chirac. By chance, I did go to France very shortly afterwards, and I did try and talk to people I was meeting who, let's face it, were largely liberal French academics. And the thing that struck me is they didn't want to talk about it. And I can remember one scene in a cafe where I was saying, what's this going on about the veil? And the person I was talking to said, shh, don't talk, you know, don't say that so loudly. And that sort of intrigued me even more, and I felt I just had to find out more. So in 2004, I did a sort of makeover. I was no longer a historian. I wanted to get involved in contemporary issues, and I was trying to find out for myself how to do that. The thing I came round to was that in order to discuss these questions properly, you must listen to Muslim voices. And that isn't as difficult as it sounds. Maybe if we were talking about 1960, you might have said, well, where do you go? Where are the publications? Already by 2004, there were websites, there were articles in papers, there were interviews. Pretty soon after 2004, I don't need to tell you this, there's a whole string of publications. The idea of listening to Muslims is not an impossibility any longer. It still is an issue, this. I'm going to have to talk very carefully in the next few moments. I recently reviewed a book from quite a major publisher with a title about Muslims in Europe. A very large book, a very long book, and I did recommend refusing it. And I refused it on the grounds that within the 120,000 words of the book, there was barely a reference to any Muslim authors. It was like they just didn't count. Muslims were still people to be seen from the outside. And I did write in my report, I will say this to you, I said this is treating Muslims like they're giant pandas, like they are only able to be looked at from the outside and to be interpreted, you know, through mysterious gestures or something. That's not necessary at all. And the book I eventually wrote was trying to do that. It was trying to listen to four people who I arbitrarily chose as French Muslim speakers and trying to analyse what they said. Another very obvious point that comes out, which again, you know, the anonymous author of that manuscript missed altogether, the need to define the topic. It sounds very obvious, a Muslim is a Muslim is a Muslim. It isn't, it's not at all obvious. There are at least three definitions of what constitutes a Muslim. The first is obviously the religious definition. Do you follow the five instructions given in the Quran? That's coherent at least. The problem is there's a lot of people who seem to be Muslims don't quite follow that. The second approach, I think, is probably correctly termed anthropological, to see being a Muslim more as a lifestyle. You can then debate exactly what constitutes that lifestyle. The importance of that second definition, it doesn't necessarily depend upon a personal faith. There are people who call themselves Muslims but don't necessarily have a religious faith. And the third definition of Muslim, which again is often forgotten, it can be an assigned identity. It's a label that other people put upon people they don't like. And the classic example of that is those riots, I think, in 2005, where some French commentators immediately labelled them as Muslim riots, when as far as we know sociologically, Muslims were not particularly prominent in them, Muslim organisations were not organising them. The word was being assigned to the rioters rather than the rioters accepting it. So that was quite a methodological break for me. It was quite an innovation. In my own teaching, I did reflect some of these issues, perhaps rather indirectly. While writing this book, I shifted the subjects, the syllabus I taught, and I began to teach a course on Israel-Palestine, which, all right, is not directly linked to the French veil whatsoever, but that's the way it worked for me. In teaching that course on Israel-Palestine, I was very pleased to see that some veil-wearing female students did turn up. And these were the first veil-wearing people I've ever spoken to. And they wanted to talk. In particular, there were a couple of French exchange students who really came, you know, wanting to meet other people, they're wanting to exchange ideas, and were quite keen to talk to me. And after a few years of this, I did realise there was something very unexpected, very unusual about veil-wearing female students, and that is that they are almost exactly the same as non-veil-wearing students. Perhaps slightly more studious, but I wouldn't even want to push that too far. They weren't very different at all. I could illustrate that point a bit at greater length. Looking back on those days and months in 2003-2004, it does feel like looking back on a war. I mean, it doesn't seem like an inaccurate metaphor at all. I felt for a while I was part of a little band. Largely, it's got to be said, of British, American, Australian commentators. Though, yes, all right, some French commentators as well. I think we were right to raise questions about French policy. I think passing that law was an incredible mistake, a really bad mistake. I think it's had entirely negative effects since September 2004. The main effects have been to give head teachers a lot more work, because remember, head teachers have to interpret what counts as an ostentatious religious symbol, and they have to do that every day as the kids are coming in through the school gates. And of course they're arbitrary. There's no consistency. This isn't the law which cleans up everything. It's a law which has messed up a lot of things. Secondly, and much more importantly, it has made a section of the French population feel marginalised, feel stigmatised. It's announced publicly that a section of the French population is suspect. And as people said at the time, this is supposed to be about inclusion. You can't build inclusion through exclusion. This is simply not possible. So I feel quite proud that I was involved with that. I feel quite proud that I did publish this book, though the writer took a bit of time to come out. And I still feel quite glad that Margaret did support me in writing that book and in helping me make that shift. And I'll end there.
Thank you very much, Sheree. Our next speaker, Andrew Smith, has come today from Chichester, where he has been taking up a senior lecturer's position. And Andrew and I both, in fact, Natalia as well, both have all had the privilege of being here. Sorry?
And it's here as well.
And it's here, yeah, we're...
Yeah, I'm not going to...
Should explain what this is, or what the link is. We're all supervised by Julia Jackson, Queen Mary University, who shares certain things in common. Now, Andrew has produced quite a lot of publications in the last few years, and among those, the most recent ones, is a book co-edited with another colleague at UCL at the time, called Past Imperfect, which is reflecting on various themes around decolonization and the end of empire. At the same time, he's also produced a monograph, which is devoted to wine growers' movements, regionalism, and to the politics of central and periphery in France. I think the way that he combines those things is in his research is very interesting. So I'm going to hand over to Andrew.
Thank you very much. I've got a bit of PowerPoint also. Should we pause or yeah. Should I nod to you?
Okay.
I should say that the Future Imperfect is open access and free. So if you do want to read it, you can download it as a PDF from the publisher's website, which is meant to be, I think, actually a good thing for getting people to read academic work. So, recently I've become interested in the way that empire lingers in French politics, and specifically how it lingers in the peripheries of a French state. I'm interested broadly in the idea that reference to the old adage of the Zambes and the Carvaes can shed some light on the rise of the radical right and its strength in former leftist strongholds like the Languedoc. For me, this shows the opportunities for working across two nominally distinct fields of scholarship and demonstrates the necessity of a post-colonial approach in considering metropolitan history and politics. Richard Montalat, deputy for the Corrèze, cited the journalist Raymond Cartier in a discussion in the National Assembly in June 1964. The ideas of equivalence, grievance, and certain xenophobia trumped overtures to identity or solidarity with the post-colonial world. Yet, in 1961, self-styled peasant protests about wine and artichokes in the Languedoc and Brittany, respectively, had made explicit reference to the Algerian conflict, and specifically deployed the language of internal colonialism as a way to fight back against the state and to critique the modernisation of the French economy, using minority nationalist symbols and deploying protest methods honed in France's colonial struggles. Many farmers in the Languedoc and in Brittany had served as conscripts in Algeria, retiring set against the war and jaded at their experience overseas. Prominent young radicals like André Gaz spent their mere 30 months national service in Algeria during the crisis, having turned 19 years of age. On his return, André Gaz was incensed by the worsening situation in the viticultural villages of the Languedoc, which he described as feudal. Like many, he took one key thing from the war, however. Direct action was effective. In fact, leaders of protest movements in Brittany and in Algeria in the summer of 1961 cited the Algerian War as an inspiration. Jean-Marie Sayeur, who served as a parachutist and was made the secretary of Breton protest leader Alexis Gouffin ex-Union in January 1961, promoted attacks, quote, like the Fellahar did in Algeria. Young men identified themselves as hardened, motivated and dangerous after the military service. And forces like the Jeunesse Agricole Chrétienne channel the passion and radicalism of these young peasant veterans. Using common methods with a colonial reference point showed this was about more than just artichokes or wine, but something more profound. And those common methods were things like cutting down telephone poles or placing explosives on railway lines. These were things that they found had been done to them while they were conscripts. They thought, you know, they talk about them down there and it worked for them, why not us try it against the central state? But these young veterans that rejuvenated syndical organisations were products of Francis' colonial struggles, returning with fresh eyes to old problems. Now, the difficulty of this is the climate of the late 1960s and early 1970s produced a remarkable convergence of causes on the political fringes, which makes the precise ideological alignment of these movements difficult to ascertain. Confluences of the global, the local, and the colonial all showed how the idea of internal colonialism mobilised and motivated protest as the concept was being developed. From the Cassville, the mines in the south, to the Larzac on the steppe, to the Mitchell, across the Besançon, and across the Andes to Assam. It also showed the importance of shifting lenses in the study of decolonisation and of modern France. Now, in terms of the historiography of minority nationalism, Charles Foster's volume, came out in 1980, Nations Without States, set the agenda for the study of nationalist movements in Europe. Building on the work of Michael Hector, who coined the Anglophone phrase internal colonialism in relation to Britain's Celtic fringe, Foster states that minority nationalism in France, set against the Jacobin legacy of the centralising state, was stirred up by the over-centralisation of political and economic authority in Paris. Michael Keating is another person who has explained resurgences of minority nationalism with reference to cyclical territorial crises, as, quote, local and regional systems of power and legitimacy were threatened by the expanding state. Now, these give us a useful understanding of how minority nationalism has developed, but restrain themselves to the focus on the structures of the state, and by describing a transactional relationship between centre and periphery. And this can make it difficult to explain some of the messiness that emerges around minority nationalism, and in particular the odd connotations that internal colonialism took on as it was adopted by diverse regional activists in the 1960s and 1970s. And sorry, I can show you some of the other kind of moments when you see it start to appear in this idea of internal colonialism, of course, play on word there, won't be do, won't be do. Which talks about, you know, the kind of very modern phrase at the top, the longue d'or plus maltraité qu'une colonie perdue. And this plays into this narrative of struggle that's used constantly. There's some cartoons from Lutte Occitane, which shares a publisher with Echo de Carpier, kind of different sides of the same coin. You can see this idea here of, first of all, the kind of unity of struggle between places like Larzac and the wine growers, but then also this sense here of the idea that, I'm sorry for the quality of the photo, but the French soldiers feel, you know, things like the Larzac is a fight they can win, but they're kind of drawing lines between all these different points. Now, this is where I think the study of regionalism can be bolstered by an understanding of the post-colonial and a stronger focus on the history of decolonisation. As observed by Todd Shepherd, the end of the 1950s, quote, gave birth to the notion that decolonisation was a causal force with an all but irresistible momentum. In Inventing Decolonisation, as I mentioned at the start, Shepherd looked at the social, political and cultural construction of the end of empire, specifically looking at the way in which the events themselves assembled into a process and created a sense of something that was a process overall. Scholars like Kristen Ross and Herman Ledwick have likewise shown how decolonisation rewrote social and cultural mores in metropolitan France. And others like Pascal Blanchard and Sophie Le Maître showed similar things in terms of how to rewrite that idea of the culture of what imperial France was. While likewise people like Véronique Dinier have demonstrated how the reintegration of colonial administrators in regional politics reinforced stratified relationships in terms of centre and periphery. When you take former colonial administrators and governors and suddenly they talk about the fact that they are still governing peasants, whether they are in Africa or in the Languedoc. Now, thinking through empire reminds us sharply that the boundaries of nations and states do not automatically align. It also acknowledges the power of the central state in shaping the relationships with the periphery, including the use of violence to maintain unequal social and economic relationships, the kind of sort of thing that, you know, both these pictures are absolutely talking about. That process inflected the vocabulary, ideology and the praxis of regional protest against the state. Yet, as with contemporary studies of decolonisation, it's important not to read internal colonialism as a flat narrative with clearly delineated sides. And in the words of Amélie Snower, to question the common sense that surrounds it, this idea that you just assume that if it's not written, then it doesn't exist. So we can connect these peasant movements in the 1960s to minority nationalism through their symbols, their strategic alliances, but also their personnel, which create a positive sense of their progressive nature. Christel Kalter's new book, The Discovery of the Third World, goes part of the way to showing how the new left engaged with global ideas. And in France, however, the fulcrum of the movement decrying internal colonialism was not always a commitment to broader social justice, nor to righting the wrongs of empire. Rather, it was an equivalence, and thus the notion of underdevelopment was key. In my current research, I want to look at this political flexibility as a means of understanding how the idea of internal colonialism became increasingly negative in its deployment. And two recent examples spring to mind. French domestic political developments that are shot through with this rhetoric of internal colonialism. So after the concentrated economic and political change which marked the Languedoc in the latter half of the 20th century, the election of Francine Almeida in Béziers made worldwide news. The long-acknowledged capital of the Midi Rouge, or Red South, had done something unthinkable. The Front National movement now goaded existing cultures of opposition into a broader rejection of the complex, distant and unpalatable language of the central state. Immigration, like Algerian wine imports, was out of control. Petty crime, a marker of Parisian neglect and urban decay. And these were voiceless threats to the people, defined as ordinary southerners willing to get their hands dirty. And an example of its political flexibility, this was the sort of decolonisation proposed by the ever-controversial Michel Onfray, and who's freely voiced and explored concerns around micro-peuple and drowning out le peuple. His latest book, Décoloniser les Provence, calls for an end to the Jacobin foundation of the Republic in favour of something altogether more Bedonian. Or indeed Christophe Guilly in La France Périphérique, who highlighted the desire in France's provinces for social and cultural, quote, réenracinement. So we can see here how you have this language of internal colonialism, which at first looks like it's part of the new left, it's positive, it's progressive, it's about kind of equality, moving towards quite unusual and radical forces, which really are pretty unpleasant and pretty toxic. So 2016, Ménard spoke in similar tones at the opening of the Ferias, a southern celebration of bullfighting, song, and regional culture. In his address, he played up a long narrative of, quote, the civilization of the vine, rooted in the region and its traditions, like the Ferias itself. I'll read you a quote, excuse me, for quoting someone like Ménard. I've said it often, this is Béziers, and as you know, the people of Béziers are proud, and they are unbowed. A people who have 1,000 years of resistance behind them, from the Cathars to the wine growers of 1907. A people who are part of a civilization, a Christian civilization, which has been around for 2,000 years and seen plenty of others. People who have their own identity and who are holding on to it. This culture of resistance has been repeatedly targeted against Paris, with symbolic clashes with central government over the erection of a nativity scene in Béziers, which is defended as being part of an Occitan Christmas, so somehow different to a French Christmas perhaps, and that's, you know, defending this idea of a minority culture against the majority culture. Against immigration, of course, the famous mocked up covers of the Béziers municipal magazine where he pretended that trains were coming destination Béziers, you know. And you see this here, you know. They can't new examples. The whole thing is about creating this sense of kind of populist resistance, which ties into this idea of internal colonialism. And when Ménard declared that the past flows into the future, he wasn't addressing the region's structural problems that contributed to his election, but issuing a populist gaucho-lepeniste appeal, binding the resentment of regional hardship with national loss. That national loss, of course, was Algeria, and his appeal was refracted strongly through the lens of Pierre Noir retrospection. Though I suspect others here will speak on that in more detail, so I'll probably hold back just now. As a second example, in the heat of France's most recent présidentiel, then LR deputy for Charles Maritime, Dominique Rousseau, sought to question Emmanuel Macron's description of French colonialism as a crime against humanity by equating the experience of being colonised with that of France's internal consolidation. Evidently, Bussereau was negating post-colonial Algeria's identity and trauma by conjuring up false equivalents from a loosely imagined history. As we may now rename the street from the date of the Evian Accord, which ended the Algerian War, to valorise an army officer implicated in the attempted OAS coup. Now, Libération, after Bussereau kind of asked this question, put that question to three historians of empire, who all, I think, probably fairly astutely dubbed it absurd. Now, both he and Ménard were whitewashing the racialized violence and torture which marred the conflict, and engaged in exactly the memory wars well described by Benjamin Stora. Further, they were sanctioning a particular form of ethno-nationalism, more akin to the ultra-conservative integralist vision of regionalism, flirted with by Onfray. And actually, I think that's where sometimes you can see the usefulness of understanding this, the history of decolonization alongside this history of regionalism. Often we talk about 19th century regionalism, of course Schering's written very well on Britain Age in the 19th century. Other people like Julian Wright, who've written about the French regionalist federation, often there's a sense of a sort of, kind of political nomadism of regionalism, that people will find allies where it counts. That's kind of reconfigured after the Second World War in that period of what the Breton might call the Third Entrap, of this new rising where it becomes attached to the new left. And so often we look at these regionalists and think, that's left, that's good, that's progressive. I think part of this helps us understand how you take someone like Baithke with this long-running left-wing heritage and find this shift towards it. Of course, there is a fair degree of racism and all the rest of it involved. I think that is absolutely inarguable. But I think it helps to try and coin some of the ideas of where that flexibility comes from. And I think it is part of a much longer narrative. So instead then of reading internal colonialism as something which emerged simply because the regions were poor and Paris in charge, we can read the history of empire and decolonisation into this story of the global and the local and begin to unpack the post-colonial entanglements that shape French politics and society. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Andrew. So our final speaker on the first panel is Natalia Vint. Natalia is a colleague here at the University of Portsmouth. Mention one of her recent publications is Our Fighting Sisters, which is a book about female veterans and women in during the Algerian War of Independence and afterwards in the nation building project of Algeria. That won the Women's History Network Prize in 2016.
Yes.
Yes. Last year.
Okay.
So
thank you. I think, of course, when you go last, it's like when you go last at book club. Everyone else has already said what you were thinking of saying. But hopefully, I'll try and... I think it feeds in very nicely with some of the things that everybody has said, and hopefully I've got a few controversial points that I'd like to open up for debate. So the starting point for my contribution is the question, who is writing new histories of decolonisation, or who do we think are writing new histories of decolonisation? And in this sense, the we are academics working largely in European and North American universities who might be American or European, or they might actually be from the countries, sort of formerly colonised countries, but who now work in European and North American institutions. So I'd like to say that I've got something more positive to say than the three previous contributors. But I'm going to start off with a publication in 2012 by the French historian Pierre Vermeron, who's professor of history at the Sorbonne, specialist of North Africa. And in 2012, he published a book which was rather uncompromisingly titled Misère de l'historiographie du Maghreb postcolonial. So poverty of the historiography of the post-colonial Maghreb or North Africa. And basically, in this book, he talks about the fact that North Africa, in his own words, has been intellectually abandoned by sort of French university. So there's various reasons he gives to this. He talks about the relative decline in posts in North African history compared to other subject areas, the fact that it's an ideological battleground, the fact that in his view, and bear in mind he's someone who's specialist of Tunisia, Morocco and Egypt, he says Algeria dominates too much. And he's also not so keen on post-colonial studies, as many French academics aren't. But actually what interests me this publication is not so much what he has to say about France, but what he has to say about Algerian historians. And he basically divides Algerian historians into three generations. So he describes the first generation as historians in the service of the nationalist movement. He doesn't actually give any names here, but I presume that he's referring to the ulema historians, so historians who basically are involved in the association of Muslim scholars in the 1930s, so people such as Tufik el-Madani, Abu Qasim Sadallah, who write, as James McDougall has so brilliantly described, sort of the history of the existence of the Algerian nation, which was denied by colonialism. All of those scholars tended to have studied in other countries in North Africa and the Middle East. Sadullah, who is sort of the father and the grandfather of history in Algeria today, got his master's degree in 1962 in Cairo, although interestingly he did his PhD at the University of Minnesota. But he's a bit of an outlier in that sense. So the first generation of Vermorand describes as historians in the service of the nationalist movement. Then he describes historians not so in the service of the nationalist movement, but still a little bit in the service of the nationalist movement. And he's talking about people such as Mahmoud Kadesh. And then he talks of a third generation who come of age, by that he means they've finished their PhDs, in the 1980s. And he gives some names here. He talks about Dahoud Yabal at the University of Algiers, Fouad Soufi, who was for a time head of the National Archives before moving on to the CRASP in Oran, Wolfgang Kengor, who is at the CRASP in Constantine, and Hassan Romaoun, who's the director of the CRASP Research Institute in Oran. And this is what he says about them. Une fois leur doctorat écrit et leur élection assurée, ils ont occupé des fonctions de pouvoir institutionnel, mais sans y créer les livres qu'on espérait. We were talking about condescending earlier. So this is the idea that they finish their PhD, they get a job, and then they sort of sit on their laurels. And he does, in fairness to him, he does talk about the structural difficulties that these historians face, the problems of accessing archives, the problems of getting visa, the problems of funding, the basic problem of library subscriptions. So a lot of the books, you know, that we access sort of online today and electronic journal subscriptions are not available in Algeria because they're too expensive. The political difficulties, obviously, of being a historian in Algeria, in a country where the state is so reliant on a certain narrative of history to underpin its political legitimacy. Also, of course, these historians sort of came of age in the 1980s, and then the 1990s happened, and the violence of the 1990s, where if you're an academic, survival, like very literally, is probably more important than writing the book than one hopes of you. And I know that Margaret Mohamed Saad, where's he gone? But in the 1990s, I know that one of the things that you were really concerned about is actually how to write, how to talk about Algeria in this period where actually research for both Algerian researchers and foreigners is so difficult. And you published Transition and Development, was it in 2002? The precision of the historian here. Anyway, moving on. But also, all of these historians that we're mentioning here are actually very active. They do a lot of field work. They don't necessarily publish a lot in journals that you would find easily accessible in sort of Britain or France, but actually they do publish in the journals of their own universities, and they do lots and lots and lots of field work. But even more significantly, Vermorand doesn't mention any Algerian scholars who came of age from the mid-1980s onwards. And this is not a coincidence, because it's from this point when the majority of Algerian historians stopped doing their PhDs in France. And this is a combination of two things. So firstly, up until the early 1980s, you got a bursary very, very easy to come and study in France, be it for a PhD or an MA. And with the economic crisis in the 1980s, all those PhD programmes suddenly dried up. And secondly, history is one of the first subjects to be Arabized, and you're starting to get, by the mid-1980s, the first generation of students who are actually more comfortable writing in Arabic than they would be in French. And so what we get is a split in the field, and it's not as straightforward as sort of Algerian historians versus French historians. It's actually French historians and Algerian historians who work in French, even though they might also master Arabic, and then on the other hand, Algerian historians who are not comfortable working in French at all. And it's actually fascinating looking at the PhD supervisors of this sort of third generation who get their PhDs in the early 1980s, because they basically got all the same PhD supervisors as all the French historians who got their PhDs there. So there's a shared sort of production of knowledge, which is very interesting to study. They share the same problematics, they share the same methodologies. There's only three PhD supervisors that have supervised every single PhD on Algerian history in France, in Algeria, up to a certain point. So if you look at Jabel, his PhD is supervised by Galisso and then Kofi Vidrovitch at Paris 7. If you look at Tengour, her PhD is again at Paris 7. If you look at Romaoun, Galisso, Paris 7, Fatma Zorgeshi, Ajron, Paris 12, Jamila Amran, Toulouse, and Ajron is also Benjamin Storov, PhD supervisor. You get where I'm going with this. All of this ends from the late 1980s onwards, and actually you get very few Algerian students doing their PhD in history in France after that. They're very, very rare, and those students that do get a bursary to go to France, very few of them actually go back to Algeria. So we have this younger generation in Algeria who are much more comfortable writing in Arabic. They've done their PhD in Algeria. They've been supervised by Arabophone supervisors, such as Sadala. He basically supervises, as far as I can tell, the whole of the history PhD department in Algeria for a very long time. A part of that is to do with habilitation and the fact that actually it's quite difficult to become a PhD supervisor both in France and in Algeria. And today in the University of Algiers is actually a unit on using sources in French. So students in history have to have a special sort of French class to use sources in French, because this is actually something that is very difficult for them. French is taught to them as a foreign language. Using sources in French is tricky. What happens to the sort of earlier generation of Francophone historians who are not bilingual, who can't adapt to this? Well, often they go into different topics. So as history is Arabized, they might go into politics or sociology. As politics or sociology is Arabized, they go into French language and literature. So this creates an amazing interdisciplinarity, but lasts for one very specific generation. And actually, we also need to talk about the flip side of that coin, which is the limited opportunity to learn Arabic both in France and actually in other European and North American countries for historians. It's actually very, very limited opportunities available there too. So at a recent conference that I attended in Skikda on students in the national movement, nearly all of the papers, like literally 95%, were on the role of the ulema, on Muslim scholars, in the development of the nationalist movement, because those are the sources that are available in Arabic, those are the books that are available in Arabic, that are available in the university libraries in Algeria. So it becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy. People work on topics for which they have the source, they create more sources, and more people work on the topic. And not only are people working on different topics, but they don't talk to each other, because in a very literal way, they actually can't talk to each other. And so the power relations being as they are, it's not just sort of two different historical fields of developing, one in Arabic, one in French, but let's face it, one in French and English is considered better than the one in Arabic. And the history of Algeria is being written without Algerians. And this becomes very evident when we look at what has been sort of termed kind of the transnational turn in sort of approaches to the Algerian independence. So a growing sort of body of literature which seeks to intertwine decolonisation with Cold War history, decolonisation with European Union history. Now, most of that has been written in English. Some of it has been translated into French. So Matthew Connolly's book has recently been translated into French. Todd Sheffer's book has fairly recently been translated into French. Matthew Connolly, people are aware of him in Algeria. He gets invited to sort of seminars and conferences and things like that. But I wouldn't say that his work has been integrated in any way, shape or form into sort of history being integrated into Algeria. Partly because of the enduring sort of political sensitivities attached to it, because what he argues is that actually the Algerian War was won in the international context, which is very politically problematic for him to say in Algeria. But also because who has the money to do transnational history? It's all very nice doing transnational history, you know, you go to that UN archives and then you might fly to Russia and then go somewhere else. This is extremely expensive. In addition to all the problems with visas that Fabienne has mentioned already. So what kinds of history are taking place in Algeria? We've talked about the particular interest in the history of the Muslim scholars, the history of the ulema, their role in the nationalist movement, but also there's a lot of local history. And I think, sort of, if you like, sort of the international sort of group of historians often are very condescending about local history. They ignore it, they marginalise it, it's quite denigrated. But actually, this is the history that Algerian PhD students are really particularly well equipped to do. They have the contacts to do it, they have the language skills to do it, and actually they're often able to build relationships with people in, you know, in the village that perhaps they're from, in order to get them to tell stories that they wouldn't perhaps tell to people from outside their own community. So I think the challenge here is to write a true micro-history. So history in the village, not the history of the village. Yeah? So thinking about the ways in which these local histories might actually answer some of the big questions that historians are interested in. So a global micro-history, if you like. But in order to do that, it's sort of necessary to bring, if you like, those big questions into those small places. And at the moment, those two different types of history, and if you like, types of historians, aren't talking to each other. And I actually think, because we're talking about Margaret, that actually in the field of literature, this division doesn't necessarily exist in the same way. I think there are much more sort of exchanges in literature than there are in history. And again, I think perhaps language plays a role in that, because you're talking about French departments talking to French departments. So, just to conclude, I think you shouldn't write a people's history without them. I think it's ethically wrong, I think it's politically questionable, and it creates methodological blind spots. And in a historiographical context, when we're all talking about connected history, I think this connection between peoples should be the first connection we make. Of course, the problem with all this history is that it's expensive. Building these links is time-consuming. It takes a long time to develop these connections. And it's not conducive to sort of churning out a tick list of publications. So in addition to sort of the structural problems of North-South, there are also fundamental structural problems in the UK university system that make this kind of research extremely difficult to do.
So we're quite advanced with time, but we're going to take a little bit more, 10 or 15 minutes extra, I think, for this session, so that we get a chance to talk and discuss those four very rich contributions. As Anastasia said, there are so many connections between them. It's really fantastic, and really these have already come from the speakers, because in a rather unusual move, they were invited to speak before they were told what the theme was. So the theme came after their talk. So that sort of worked out very well. Clearly, the idea of power relations and voice is what runs through all of those papers very strongly. And yet, questions of who is speaking and how and from where. Sort of runs through them. I maybe just throw out a broad question for a couple of you and then turn to everyone else. In terms of this, you mentioned at the end, of say, this North-South divide, and this came through as well very much in Fabienne's paper. Is there a sense in which the Anglo-American Francophone tension is there as well, and in what sense is that creating a triangle in some of these contexts, whether it be Algeria or Senegal, Francophone, Anglophone? Is there a sort of, is that creating new tensions or opportunities for voices to emerge in a different way in how that operated? And in terms of Sherif and your work, I was just wondering what you thought had changed since 2010, if anything, whether your approach to that work that you produced then would change if you were writing it today. And then finally, Andrew, fascinating on this in terms of this research and the ideological ambiguity of regionalism. And I think yours is a very good example of how work on decolonization and France is kind of moving into new and less obvious places at the moment in a very interesting way. What I want to ask about that was anti-communism. It may sound a bit narrow, but in what sense is there a sort of chronology developing? In what sense is there a rupture between revanchard anti-Algeria, revanchard French Algerian nostalgia and something, and regionalist movements? I'm quite getting a sense of that connection. Come through. How sort of anti-communism maybe played out. Would you like to take some more questions first, Jan, and then sort of see how that goes through? So let's do that. Olivia.
My name is Olivia Sadiqa. I very much enjoyed all four. I think I have, I get two general questions, and everybody speaks to answer them. I'm not sure the questions are already formulated in my head. The first one I would have is inspired by Andrew's talk. When I heard internal colonization, I was thinking about how in the Black Power movement, the same argument is being made. But the biggest difference, obviously, with the regionalism that we see in Europe is that there is a race or racism element. So I was wondering, because you do mention it, and there's a lot of the things that we try to formulate that is wrong in this North-South or unequal, and we use a million other words, let's say condescension, and it's an open question, to what extent is it useful to more systematically deploy the concept of racism in structural terms, I mean, so not necessarily about good and bad people, but what are we doing by trying to give it all different names? Because I think that might be a way in which, when we try to think about decolonization and how it can be taken back or, you know, deformed into a right-wing project, let's say, that's where it would most naturally maybe stop. And my second question, again, is to all of you, I guess, but I guess it follows Natalia's talk. But following on all the structural problems that have been highlighted in terms of doing research about these other places, let's say, and specifically about decolonization, I was wondering, because it might be useful, to what extent these insights of the structural differences, the inequalities that are reproduced in little things like a visa application, whatever, does that inspire you personally as a researcher from the Global North, myself included, to shift our research or do things differently? So how can we make sure that the things that we actually see happening next to us all the time, are there implications in terms of where we should put our priorities, stuff that we should research more or not research these to other people? Again, a very important question.
Would you like to respond?
Sure. So first of all, in response to your question about anti-communism, that's a little bit more difficult in the Languedoc because of the history of viticultural representation, in which there are many prominent communist voices. Like Emmanuel Maffre-Roger is one of the leaders of the viticultural movement. So there's always this strong kind of involvement of communist voices across this broad spectrum of the life. The big shift comes around the mid-1980s, and that's really to do with the way that government policies about ameliorating the wine market change, to do with uprooting. And actually, I think where that pivot happens is kind of how you start to answer Olivia's question as well, because I think that's where some of that language becomes used. Like the language of internal colonialism, I think, is something of a floating signifier. I think there is a kind of signifier, or it's like very politically flexible, or I think what I'm trying to say is that it fits a number of things. So what it voices is a sense of grievance, and I think that the nature of that grievance easily maps with other things. Racism is absolutely one of them, because I think what you see when someone like Benal uses that is he's tying into this thing. When he talks about, you know, the history of the civilization of the vine, he's not talking about a history of protest, a history of kind of radical interventions. He's not talking about MIVOC, the Occitan Wine Growers movement and their overtures to autogestion and all this kind of stuff. He's talking about roots and soil and all this kind of stuff, you know? I think that's where some of that comes in, because that flexibility of language really, really is strongly identified. There's always a whiff of whether or not, when people are talking about Algerian wine and the idea of imports, whether it's really a kind of racial code, effectively. I think probably for the majority of activists in the wine movement, it's not, because they complain just as much about Italian wines. They complain just as much about Spanish wines. Really what they don't want is other wines. So there is an extent to which that is just, you know, protectionism. You know, it's basic protectionism. But there is, I think, as kind of uprooting becomes more and more important, as the region suffers. And the important thing to remember is the wine industry in Languedoc is, you know, like shipbuilding in Glasgow and Newcastle for most of the century. When that starts to kind of deindustrialise, if you will, and that's problematic language for anyone involved in rural studies, but whatever. When it starts to deindustrialise, we see some of these same patterns you would get in the sort of, you know, the stereotype of the labour voter in Bolton turned UKIP sort of thing. That same pattern where similar kind of language for old grievances is remapped onto kind of new grievances, as well as having like old things like race involved. So I think there's a big space to talk about where racism is being kind of coded within this language of internal colonialism, and coded alongside kind of, you know, it's always a problem saying, like, when people talk about legitimate concerns, you know, and trying to understand these kind of things, it gets coded into the fact saying, well, people are allowed to be racist. That's really, I think, part of it is trying to understand that there is a massive racist element involved in this, but I think there is also, there's something more canny being used, and there's something which works for certain political activists, and part of it is understanding the power of that so that it can be combated and kind of, you know, worked against, and again, those kind of situations. For me, that's where the interest in that comes.
Yes, in terms of your question, Ed, about sort of the interactions between fertilisation between sort of Anglo-American scholarship and Francophone scholarship. As you say, there are tensions. I know sort of Todd Shepherd's work is quite divisive in France. There are people who sort of really go into his idea about sort of the remaking of France. There are people who reject it often quite violently, and the reason for that is because it introduces the idea of race, and it's because we're talking about race that this suddenly becomes sort of a very problematic idea to engage with in the context of the supposedly sort of colourblind republic. I think possibly there is sort of a generational difference. I think certainly sort of people doing their PhDs now, often they're sort of more engaged with sort of some of the scholarship sort of written in English. What opportunities does that present? I mean, it's quite fascinating what works haven't yet been translated, like La Grande Crème de l'Oubli, never been translated into English. It's really interesting that's never been translated into English. James McDougall's History and the Culture of Nationalism has never been translated into French. Obviously that's more recent, but still only sort of 10 years old. So I still think, you know, the sort of barriers there, which are linked to the way in which you sort of see who the main player is in that conflict. So if you think that it's all about France to a certain extent, you're not going to be looking at, you know, the international context of the war of independence, which is also why that more recent scholarship hasn't found much of an echo in Algeria either. So fundamentally, your view on why that war came to an end and the end that it took, which is a very political view in many ways, is going to shape the kinds of scholarship that you do or don't engage with. In terms of racism, you're absolutely right, Olivia, that's the term that we should be using. I mean, when you look at who gets a job in French academia, there's not really another word to use. It's very striking that sort of a younger generation of sort of PhD students who are, say, Franco-Algerian or Franco-Moroccan or Franco-Tunisian, they find it extremely hard to get a job. They're the people that don't get a job. They often don't have the same sort of go brought you about, they're not héritiers, so often their parents might have been quite working class, they don't have sort of the same intellectual baggage as some of their white peers, and those two things, their social class and their race, sort of intertwine, and they're the people permanently sort of on temporary contracts, who never get sort of a permanent job, and so on and so forth, and that has a very important impact on the field as well. Look at who is writing colonial history in France. It is very, very, very pale. So that's a really important point. We should call it out. Again, it's extremely politically sensitive. Yeah, should we be saying it's because they're from working class families, or is it because they're actually they're Arab or Muslim or whatever? And there's a whole debate about that, as you well know. And in terms of sort of the structural inequalities, does it inspire you to shift your research and do things differently? I think it should. I think it should inspire us to learn more language, you know, learn the languages. It's something I've been trying to do, and it's not necessarily easy because it's time consuming. And as I mentioned, all the other things that you're supposedly meant to be doing, and forms that are very important to fill in, apparently, and other things like that. That take you away from what you actually should be doing. One of the things that I've been trying to do this year, because I've been based in Algeria, is actually in a very, very sort of small way, but sort of work on translation. So getting some of sort of the key texts sort of translated into Arabic and, you know, giving them to students in the Department of History so at least, you know, they can read them. And vice versa, actually asking those students what they're working on, finding out what they're doing, taking an interest in the kind of history that they're writing, because that's important. I think, did you use the Anne-Laure Stoller quote about, what was the quote exactly about?
The idea of common sense in the archive and like looking at things that are missing from it, I think I said.
Yeah, but you know, I think there's sort of this idea sometimes in sort of, you know, the global north, that just because we haven't read it, it doesn't exist. And certainly I think that's something that we need to combat as well, and have a little bit of humility about the limits of our knowledge.
Yeah, I think it's really easy to kind of to forget that a whole kind of historiography exists just because you can't read it. You know? It's super easy to talk about the right somewhere and then just, boom, you don't read any of that stuff, so you just forget it exists.
Okay, some responses to what you're saying, Ed. What's happened since 2010 is, I think, French academia has been largely silenced, has both silenced and been silent about issues of ethnicity, issues of racism. There have been some studies of laïcité, I mean, endless, and some of them very good, you know, very thorough, even slightly critical. The dominant voice is, we've solved this problem. Laïcité solves this problem. There isn't anything to discuss. Some of you may know better than I do what's actually happening at French universities, and what's happening to postgrads, and what's happening to supervisors. But one's impression is this is just regarded as a non-subject. A while ago, I was asked to do a sort of survey article, and I said, great, yeah, I can do that. And then their sort of second instruction came, a survey article, but it must concentrate on things written by academics. And I said, well, I can't do that. The best debates are often polemical, often bad-tempered, often emotional, but they're happening outside the university, not inside. And so eventually I just had to say, sorry, no, I can't do that. The other thing that's changed, and this is very, very difficult to talk about, of course, are those terrorist attacks. You can't deny that that's changed the mood. In sociological terms, it's obviously a tiny, tiny, tiny minority of the French Muslim population. But in cultural terms of how Muslims are viewed in France, just like 9/11, it hasn't transformed things, but it has rigidified and exacerbated an already bad situation. And I think you should think anyone starting a PhD would have to look at those attacks and say, you know, make a statement about them, come out about them. And let's face it, that's difficult to do. It's not an easy topic to write about. So it's a pretty pessimistic outlook, Lyon, since 2010.
Yes. Yeah, with regards to your question about new voices, I don't know. I mean, I don't know the extent to which you can actually generalize it, but I did find that there was a very fascinating and amazing intellectual creativity in clinical, especially amongst young researchers and PhD students. When you go in the archives, well, many of you probably know it's a great place to meet people and to meet PhD students. And when you talk about them, it's just, yeah, they have, I don't know, I think there is, they have this, I don't know if it's a matter of generation, it probably has to do with it, but they have, they're in a place where they actually, I don't know, it's like they are completely freeing themselves about front gates somehow. And many of them I was talking with were saying that that they're glad that there is this whole generation of new historians who are not thinking anymore about doing their studies in France, but are thinking about going in Anglophone countries such as the US or Britain, obviously. And so I think there is a sort of shift in terms of scholarship in Senegal. And a lot of creativity, because they actually can articulate concepts and notions very easily from one field to another, really, between the Francophone field and Anglophone field. So that's really fascinating. Yeah, about shift in doing research. I don't know. I mean, all of this is still very fresh to me, so I don't know. And I'm not. I don't have the feeling either that I'm that what I said was just groundbreaking. And I think it's really pretty basic things. But one thing I'm going to do, and that I did, yes, is that I'm going to work with one of the one researcher in Senegal, and we talked about it with Tony, and thought it might be a good idea that that he'd be a part of my supervisory team, and go back to Dakar, definitely, in order to, I don't know, yeah, to go back to the basics, basically. I just felt that we have a sense of, I don't know, sometimes when we talk about all these theories, sometimes it feels like a dead end, or it's going into a circle. And I don't know, just being in Dakar just helped me to have, all, you know, I felt like I was in the first or second year student again, and then I have all these things to learn, and that's just great, really, so yeah, going back there, definitely.
Margaret and Rob, would you like to ask some questions? My name is Rahul von Abdullah. I've got one quick question, I think primarily for Fabien, but perhaps others have experience as well. I was wondering, in FIU experience, if at all, a sort of new winter in terms of archival access, whereby perhaps institutionally or otherwise, it has become more difficult to get sources. I find that
in Senegal, you mean,
perhaps within French or European archives. But my own experience is that I had more difficulty getting access to documents on French government in French archives. And quite the opposite was true from a French perspective to archives in South Africa. But even there, you can see that things are changing again for the worse. So I'm wondering what your experience are in that regard.
I don't know. I have a feeling that archives in France and archivists are really up front, and which is, I guess, maybe different from the British approach to archives. I don't know. Yeah, I guess, I mean, I'm not quite sure that archives are harder to access in France than in any other European country or any other country at all. Maybe, yeah, it's just a matter of being upfront and saying that, yeah, no, you're not granting the access, and that's it. But the main problem, I mean, besides the debate about making the archive accessible in terms of legislation, which is a huge debate, really, because on the one hand you have to access sources to the history, and it's a basic right that citizens should access to archives too. At the same time, you need to protect private information, so that's a bit tricky, and there's a lot of things to discuss there. But apart from that, I think that many archives, many colonial archives especially, are not accessible for material reasons, and that's something that to me that's more of an issue than the legislation problem. Because it's not as visible as the legislative issue, and it's actually it's a political issue too, because it's a matter of how much governments want to invest in the archives to make them accessible, to write that part of history and to rewrite it, to which effect, because it's, if they do that, they take the. Well, it might mean that the narrative is going to change. And it brings us back to the question of issuing visas and everything, especially for historians coming to France. I think that in terms of accessibility to archives, there is more of an issue in terms of preservation and putting efforts and money into making these archives accessible. Many, many collections and many boxes in X are not accessible right now and have never been opened because of the lack of means, basically.
Thank you.
Yeah, well, I want to thank all four of you for opening up the discussion to many different perspectives, really, on the questions of doing research in what is a highly criticised field, which we've all had experience of. Very briefly, some of you touched on this Anglophone-Francophone divide and whether it makes a difference to the kind of research which is done and how it's done. And I just wanted to ask you briefly, if you feel like responding to this question, which is, in the Anglophone context, more specifically in the British context, because we're not really talking about Anglophone, I'm talking about British on this subject, there's been the anniversary of the 70th year of Indian independence. And I don't know how you, because you're all working in British institutions, although I know Natalia has been there, but I have been really struck by the coverage of that in the media. And also, I mean, it occurs to me that in academic terms, there is actually very, very little work being done on that question of Indian independence, decolonisation in India. And I just wondered if you had any thoughts on that. The media coverage certainly has been not about decolonisation and Indian independence as such, but is almost entirely focused on the question of partition. Mm-hmm. And I just wondered if, don't feel obliged to say anything you don't want to, but I'd just like your opinion.
I think the British have a very self-satisfied narrative about decolonisation, in which basically they were better than the French and they did it better, because fundamentally they were better colonial rulers. And for all we, you know, as academics working in British universities, looking at France and sort of critiquing France for failing to come to terms with its colonial past, actually I think there's more debate in French universities and in French public space than there is in Britain, and I think that really came to light around the debates around Brexit last year, when suddenly emerged, for me it seemed to be out of nowhere, this sort of nostalgic account of, you know, when Britain ruled the Wales and had this empire that wasn't particularly present in public space, but was clearly sort of there and being nourished somewhere, because around the debates around Brexit it sort of re-emerged to sort of justify the fact that, you know, we can stand on our own and look how great we are because we're great, etc., etc. And I think that's really quite striking, that there has been very little questioning in Britain of the sort of the colonial legacy, that this, there is this idea, oh, we're better at race relations, we can talk about race, we're nicer to Muslims, that I think is not true. But the debates take place in different forms, and there is on the part of, sort of, you know, ordinary people that appear on your Facebook feed from time to time, you realise, you know, from your little academic bubble, that there are people who really have never questioned how great the British colonial empire was and how nice we were to everybody with all those roads and schools that we built. And I think we need to be very aware of that and not fall into this, you know, self-satisfying thing of critiquing France without thinking about what that says about us and where we're writing from.
That is something I've been touching on quite a lot lately, and I think also when it comes to Indian decolonisation, I think a lot of British historians who are actually focused on trying to critique this narrative, they also turn a very willing blind eye to that, also because they are very aware of how this narrative of successful decolonization in India has been spun for quite a long time. And usually if British historians who look at decolonization are very aware of some kind of mission to critique that narrative, they will go to Kenya. They will focus on Kenya. They will focus on Malaya. They will focus on trying to look at migrated archives, and they know that there is some kind of an Indian conundrum there, an Indian conundrum in which India, for such a long time, has been the jewel in the crown, and yet there has been very little debate about that in a process of decolonization that gave birth to some of the worst violence of decolonization, and yet has been celebrated or was celebrated on that same day in Britain as Britain's day of glory. And it is quite difficult, I think, for historians to get their meat into that, and they usually try to avoid that, even if you look at the kind of big John McKenzie trying to talk about how decolonization was not so let's say benign and benevolent after all. What he tries to do is to say, well, don't look at India. Try and look at what happens afterwards, but don't look at India. India is the exception. And I think that is also probably in British historiography is one of the main difficulties of thinking about British colonialism, usually through the lens of India as the big colonial endeavour, and yet also historians trying to avoid that. But that might be something.
Just actually thinking about this idea of blind eye and putting my question to Natalia. It's true that there is this blind eye also from Algerian academics and Algerian historians who talk a lot about the lack of access to the Algerian archives available in France. But they never talk about the archives of the GPRA, L'Armée Régulière, which was based in Oujda, the different wilayets, all of them have got quite a lot of archives, but they never talk about them. And then if I can just ask one question or two to Natalia. You mentioned a few French academics who kind of have the monopoly of supervising PhDs on Algerian history. You have mentioned Harbi and Stora. Are they involved in that? And the other thing, that whether you have a view about that. From where I am, which is in the UK, I do watch films, and we were talking about new films and Algerian films, and also read papers. And I have noticed for the past 4 or 5 years, there is an emergence of probably new historians who are good, And I'm thinking about two, one from the University of Constantine and one from the University of Oran, but don't ask me about the name. But I think this emergence is also kind of trying to put the point of their region or their views. And the films that have also been recently produced have also kind of, you know, very cleverly, I saw the film about Ben-Gurion, and I saw the film about Zavala, and there were a few information which were not available to the public for quite a very long time. And I'm just wondering whether there is some access to some or part of the archives in France or transferred that are being kind of put in those films, you know, about how Ben-Gurion was killed and who is responsible. And also whether you follow, Natalia, the conflict between Yosef Saadi and Madame Diouf. Suddenly we saw a letter from the French authorities about what Yosef Saadi might have done or might have not done.
Was it with Louise Hilaris, not Zora Dreef? Was it with Zora Dreef? Was it with Dreef or Hilaris?
I think it was Yosef Saadi versus like a footballer.
I think it was Louise Hilaris.
Whether you have kind of have noticed that, but I mean the debate from the historian, Algerian historian, is great. I enjoyed watching it. But each of them has got his own perspective, trying to defend either his region or his.
Okay. Thank you. Probably going to have to make that the last of the questions because we were running a little bit. We're hoping there's going to be some lunch available in the next room. So he's finding out.
I'll be really, really quick. Thanks for those questions. I'm sure we can continue the discussion over lunch. But you're right, there has been a massive increase in the films about people who participated in the War of Independence, in public debates about who was a traitor, who wasn't a traitor, what's the proof that they were a traitor. And you're absolutely right as well that, you know, if you have a statue in the East, you have to have a statue in the West. It all has to be balanced out, you know, respect sort of, you know, regional sensitivities. I think sort of what I would say about all of that is that it seems to be a debate, but actually there's only very limited kinds of things that are being debated, and a lot of it is what I would term sort of consensual criticism, that they seem to be having a debate about war, but there's a fundamental set of ideas that are not being debated, and that is that fundamentally true veterans are all good, that they're all good people, and sort of the idea that just because you participated in a war that you are a good person is quite an interesting thing to sort of unpack. That's never ever questioned. So we debate who might be a real veteran, but never being a veteran is a good thing, or that they are good people. That the war was by the people, for the people, one so hero the people. So that sort of message might have sort of regional variance, but actually there's sort of a core of shared ideas that are never really sort of debated. But we can maybe talk about that more over lunch. In terms of Benjamin Stora, you're right. I'd mentioned that Agron was his PhD supervisor, but Stora has supervised nearly every PhD about Algeria sort of from the 1990s onwards. And that's quite interesting. But that is because actually becoming a PhD supervisor is very difficult in France, as French colleagues will know better than me, that you have to go to the habilitation. So it's actually very, relatively speaking, compared to the UK, very small number of people who can supervise PhDs. And to my knowledge, Mohamed Harbi hasn't got the habilitation, so he would never actually be allowed to supervise a PhD student. And then just a final point about the public narratives and how they're sort of tied up with historical knowledge. I wonder maybe this is something we could talk about in the final session, sort of with Olivia. But certainly, when I talk about colonial history, I'm always very careful when I'm talking about it as a general public as well, much more careful and guarded than I would be than talking about it here with you. I've just remembered this podcast. but I don't think it's going to be used for the Portsmouth News. But I can remember this like pointless Facebook debate. I got involved with this man that I didn't even know that lived in Portsmouth at the moment of the Brexit debates, and he was like, you know, going on, oh, Britain was great before we were in the European Union. Look, we won the Second World War. And so, you know, I said, well, you know, we didn't win the Second World War on our own. You know, you might want to think about, you know, Polish airmen who came and joined the RAF, or the fact that we had allies, or indeed all these colonial troops. But, of course, what I was doing there was like a glorification of colonial troops without any assessment, you know, critical assessment of what they actually did or why they were fighting. To a certain extent, reproducing the stereotype of the loyal colonial soldier. And I think it's an issue in a world in which, you know, some of our elites are not very intelligent, that you feel that you have to speak in a very, very simple way. But fundamentally, you're sort of combating essentialism with another form of essentialism. So maybe we can talk about that over lunch.
Great. Thank you very much to all our panellists. Just thank them again. And,